Later, more of us came here in our own ships and captured Chak's vessels. We call your craft Tangle Ships. What happened here? What happened to you? We planted colonies across the artifact, the Wheel. We kept in touch using the Tangle Ships. Sometimes we transferred personnel, humans, and ghosts from one habitat to another. Once, humans being transported between cupworlds on a spline vessel rebelled, escaped from their cages. They managed to disable the spline. It crashed here on this cupworld, crashed, and died. Jophiel was aware of a fist-pumping gesture by Max Ward. Poole said, "There were survivors. Humans and ghosts." "There was a rescue. By Tangleship. Most of the ghosts were taken off."
"Not all."
"Not all. All but one of those left behind were killed by the rebellious humans."
"All but one? All but you?"
"Yes."
Poole walked around the frame, the pinned ghost. "They did this to ensure you could not escape."
"Yes. If I tried, I would rip..."
I understand."
"But to prevent my escape was not the only purpose of the framing. They thought I would die slowly, in pain."
"You did not die."
"Ghosts are not designed to die. My damaged organs internally recovered. My skin heals continually over the wood of the stakes. I am not fed, but my body ingests organic matter from the stakes themselves, which are periodically replaced, and periodically my skin is exposed to daylight for energy. Thus I have lived for 5,000 years. Michael Poole, will you help me?"
Poole seemed to consider. Then he turned and walked away. Jophiel stormed over. "What are you doing? You can't leave this creature in such torment. Shame Nicola isn't here. She'd compare this to a circle in hell, and we, human beings from your fleet of scatterships, Michael, put this ghost in it." "But the ghosts brought that crew here in the first place."
Poole seemed distracted.
Max Ward joined them, with Asher, others.
"Are you talking about the ghost? Who cares about that Leith-spawned monster? None of that matters, Michael, none of it. All that matters is that we get out of here while we can, leave this world."
Poole frowned. "Why the rush?"
Max said, "Because this world is poor, Michael. Because there's nothing for us in this environment."
He grimaced. "Look at this place. The whole world is a lie in a way. It has wood and sandstone, but dig down a little way and you find nothing but hull plate. There are going to be no fossil fuels or metals, nothing but soft rock you can't even make decent arrowheads from. You notice that? They just sharpen wooden shafts. These people were descended from scatship crew, remember? Our own colleagues from just a few years back, who set out equipped as we are with fourth millennium technology, with flyers and flitters and food printers, all of it lost. Forgotten after 5,000 years. If we stay here, we'll be the same in a few generations. Living through the same cycle over and over, slavers and war and a bit of peace and then more slavers. That's all there is here. That and counting the days and tattooing your face."
Asher said, "These people have survived. They have built a culture. There are worse fates."
Max shrugged. "So what? This isn't what we came for."
Poole was silent.
"He might, or might not, have become a good leader," Jophiel reflected, "but he had become a good listener."
"We should take our time," Poole said at length. "In the teepee, the elders told me a bit about the libraries, the crater features, especially the one at the mouth of the big river, the Great River, as they call it, where they deposit their own information, their counts of the days. Let's go there. Like you said, Max, whatever there is to learn, we'll find it there. Then we'll decide on our next steps. He started to walk away, out of the village, in the direction of the flyer. Jophiel took a step after him.
But we can't leave the ghost behind. Not like this, Michael. Michael!
He hears you, Max said softly. He just doesn't want to decide yet. Listen, I think I changed my mind. About the ghost, I mean. You want my advice? We should bring it. Jophiel scowled. Why?
It would be interesting to explore ways to kill it.
He grinned.
Hypothetically.
Chapter 55. Jophiel thought that the smartest decision Michael Poole made in the aftermath of the discovery of the ghost was to decree 2 full days of rest before they took another step forward. All of them, travellers, locals, and one representative of an entirely alien species, had been through huge conceptual shocks. If Jophiel had learned one thing, in the tangled history he shared with Michael going back to the first eruption of the Chile into the solar system, it was that the effects of such upheavals took time to work through the soul. And a couple of days' delay also happened to fit with the villagers' plans for their next regular expedition to the library at the mouth of the Great River. In the interim, Max Ward got to work setting out a perimeter around the flyer and establishing guard routines. Local children trailed around wide-eyed after Chinello and other young skin-suited warriors from the Cauchy as they made their patrols. Jophiel wondered if that would work out as a subtle way of building bridges. Harris Kemp, meanwhile, had 2 patients to attend to, Nicola in the flyer and the crucified ghost, which he was treating in a hastily improvised lean-to outside the aircraft.
Because there is no way, Max Ward had insisted, that I am going to allow a potentially hostile alien inside our one and only means of escape from this cup world.
Even Jophiel, who instinctively opposed everything that came out of Max's mouth, couldn't argue with that. Harris, for one, was glad to have the ghost on hand.
It's helping me treat Nicola, he admitted on the first day. Nicola is a kind of cartoon version of a ghost. Having an original to study is helping me figure out some of her internal scrambles. Now I can figure out what Wiener's arrow actually broke, and what just looks like it's broken.
The ghost itself was quiet, passive. It would respond to questions put to it by Jophiel and others, but stayed silent otherwise. It did seem to appreciate the effort it had taken by Poole and the rest to get the locals to release it.
"You have saved me from torment," it said on the second day. "I am in your debt forever."
"That might be true," Jophiel said dryly. "But you haven't actually told us much about your people, your ships, your mission here."
Which was true. To the detailed questions put to it by Jophiel, Max, Ward and others, its default answer was, "I do not have that information," or "I was a very junior component of a very large mission."
"There must be more of you," Jophiel said. "The chances of us stumbling so quickly upon the only ghost in this cup world are pretty slim. Don't you have any curiosity about others of your kind? What if they're having as bad a time as you were? Wouldn't you wish to help them?"
"I do not have that information. Even if I did, I could not help them. I can scarcely travel in camouflage in a human world, even if I were free."
"You've said nothing meaningful about your ship."
"I had specific duties concerning food provision units."
Which, when described, sounded to Jophiel like nothing so much as artificial mock-ups of deep-sea mineral vents on Earth, black smokers around which bacteria, crabs, and pale fish would gather to feed off seeping minerals, perhaps a clue to the ghost's ultimate origin, Asher had suggested. "What was your ship's mission?"
"I do not have that information."
But the ghost rolled as it said this, its motions visible from the orbits of scuffs and scars on its once seamless silver hide. And Jophiel had the vague, unquantifiable impression that it was glancing up at the sky. "Do you fight wars? I mean, among yourselves?" He expected another deflection, but to his surprise the ghost replied, "Only historically." "Historically?" "That may not be the right term. We evolved out of war-making against each other." Jophiel barked a laugh. "As we aspire to, I suppose. So maybe we have something in common." "All sentient beings in the universe have something in common," the ghost said. Jophiel asked on impulse, "What's your name?"
"Name?"
"Do you have a name?"
"Our identities are evident to other ghosts, at a level below symbolic communication."
That sounded to Jophiel like a pompous circumlocution describing a kind of telepathy. The ghost said now,
"Besides, I am here alone, perhaps alone on all this wheel, despite your statistical arguments. To you, I am unique. What need have I of a name?"
Jophiel had no answer. Chapter 56. On the third day, a rough expedition assembled. It was going to take about a day, they were told, to reach the library by the great river. Couchy crew members gathered diffidently around a group of villagers who carried offerings of food, roots, fruit, dried lizards, even fish from the lesser rivers, in baskets woven of tree bark. For the library, Jophiel supposed. And there were a few warrior types, bearing spears and bows, though the mood seemed light enough. As for the crew, Michael Poole and Jophiel were leading, with Harris Kemp taking a day off from the care of his two unique patients. Asher came too, in case the library did turn out to contain useful information for her to decipher. Max Ward sent along Chinello and a couple more of his cadets as guards, but stayed back himself to watch the flyer, and Jophiel couldn't argue with that priority. And Weena proudly presented herself to Michael Poole.
"I, Weena, will guide your folk," she announced, "for I wounded your warrior."
"You don't need to be paying us back," Asher said. "You were only doing your duty as you saw it."
"That is true. But now I have a duty to you, as long as you live among us."
"Then we accept," Jophiel said gently. So the expedition led by Weena set off. Not that the Couchy crew needed a guide, geographically anyhow. They would simply walk along a well-trodden trail to the nearby stream, then follow that downstream to its confluence with the great river, and then track that to the ocean shore. From there, it seemed, the library would be obvious. But if the geographic landscape was simple, the human landscape was deeply complex. It turned out that they would have to skirt the territories of two other groups en route. At the first encounter, the Couchy folk quickly learned the rules. There were special places, indistinguishable to Jophiel, where you had to stand and wait until noticed by a scout from the local community. There would be some shouting, a few ritual challenges, a spear waving. Then you said where you were going and how long you would be, and permission to pass was grudgingly given, or not. But Jophiel suspected that was rare. Then, with the formalities over, you sat down in the shade for the more important business of the day. Gossip, nostalgia, and speculations about who was likely to be marrying whom soon. The Couchy crew were the subject of polite curiosity, but as they seemed to be the property of Weena's folk, nobody questioned them directly. Jophiel wondered, in fact, if maybe the first slaver villagers had been so keen to make this trip just so they could show off the crew to their neighbours. All this with warriors like Weena, carrying lethal weapons always close to hand. But Jophiel suspected that most clashes between groups of people here were going to be more symbolic than deadly. Displays of identity, territory-marking rituals, yes, maybe some blowing off of steam when there were disputes. A couple of champions swinging their fists. Surely the folk here were too spread out for intense conflicts to be common, with too little property to be worth fighting over. And besides, these long-established groups evidently had deep, shared links of territory-marking and marriage bonds, reliant on a deep and intricate knowledge of past history.
Which is, Jophiel muttered as he discussed this with Asher, what we're likely to find locked up in this library of theirs. Generations of gossip.
Yes, but how rich all this is, Asher said, with a kind of fond enthusiasm in her voice. I mean, look around. Here we are in a world like a bowl of dust, the people with nothing but animal skins and bits of wood. Their origins almost forgotten, yet their cultural life is so complex, so colourful, like a cloud of light over all their heads. That's humanity for you. It was just the same on the ships, of course. Environments that were even more deprived in many ways, and Shinello's generation were evolving their own intricate culture in response, right under the noses of the adults.
Jophiel smiled. I remember. Graffiti in the corners, the bracelets and necklaces they made out of bits of waste.
Well, I don't recall that stuff, Michael Poole broke in grumpily. And all the gossip in the world about whose aunt is marrying whose uncle isn't going to get us any closer to the Chile. Despite this impatience, however, Poole kept a polite smile on his face through all this complicated manoeuvring, and Jophiel felt obscurely proud of him for that. The meeting ended with a still more elaborate round of farewells, with all the visitors touching heads one at a time with all their hosts, and a slow, almost regretful departure. A little further along the riverbank, they crossed yet another band's territory, and had to go through the same ritual all over again. But Weena and their guide seemed relaxed. Evidently they had factored all this delay into their estimate of a day's march to the library. It was well past the middle of the day by the time they reached the great river itself. It was wide, sluggish, tinged red with dust. Jophiel knew from the hasty aerial surveys they had made that this was an impressive enough waterway, kilometres wide here, draining a continent, a veritable Mississippi 25,000 light-years from the frozen relic of the original. And there was some traffic on the slow-moving water, Jophiel saw. Canoes and larger vessels made up of many canoes bolted together, like multiple-hung catamarans. Their occupants seemed to be dredging up a kind of water-adapted grass, as well as setting out nets for fish. The river-born folk waved to the walkers as they passed, without any territorial challenges. Evidently the river was seen as a common good, shared by all, during times of peace, anyhow. And there was wildlife here, as Jophiel might have expected, close to the water. Asher pointed out some detail. Those swimming mammals by the bank, they look like otters. They're rats, aren't they? And those are big, long-legged rabbits on the far bank taking a drink. Those wading birds with the bright crests. Chickens. And those trees by the water, a little like banyans, look like a variant of willow. The gourd carried a parkland ecohab. Turn all that out onto a dusty plain, leave it to adapt for a few thousand years, and this is the result. After tracking the river a while, Jophiel sensed they were approaching the sea. He thought he heard the deeper rumble of a more massive body of water, smelled salt in the air. He never got to see the ocean, however. There was no horizon on this tabletop of a landscape, but the mist in the air limited visibility. And before the ocean came into view, the path, well-trodden, veered away from the riverbank and cut directly across the landscape. Soon they came to a rise in the land, like a ridge or an earthwork, heaped up rusty dirt 2 or 3 times Jophiel's own height. Jophiel could see it followed a broad circle, like the wall of a crater. He guessed the diameter was a couple of kilometres, maybe more. Evidently one of the features that had looked so common and prominent, viewed from the air. The trail they now followed converged on a circular track, heavily worn, that looped around the exterior of the earthwork. They trudged along this. More tracks trailed in from the wider landscape to join this perimeter. This was evidently a common destination point. The villagers bunched up closer together as they walked on. They had all fallen silent now, villagers and crew alike, as if through some shared perception. Jophiel knew that his template, Michael Poole, had never been swayed much by intuition, by feelings about places and situations. But Jophiel did sense a general unease. At last they came to a break in the wall, a wide gap. There was nothing like a gate. Within the enclosure, Jophiel could see a kind of pyramid, a roughly finished four-sided heap, standing on heavily trodden ground at the centre of the big, circular earthwork. The group started to move through the gap in the wall, and Asher brushed Jophiel's hand, creating consistency protocol warning tingles. "Look around," she muttered, "at the wall itself." The sides of the cutting through which they passed were quite steep slopes, earth bound together by coarse grass. The earth was so dry it was almost like a sand dune, Jophiel thought. A sand dune from which bones protruded. He recoiled, then he forced himself to look more closely. Skulls, ribs, joints, some of them smashed, perhaps by animals seeking marrow. Jophiel had an absurd image of one of those big, tough-looking chicken descendants pecking angrily at this ossuary. His companions reacted too. Cinello gaped in horror. Asher glared as if affronted. The villagers kept their heads down as if in respect as they passed through the bank. By now Jophiel was pretty sure he knew what they were encountering, and so did Michael Poole, he saw, glancing over at his template. "Uncle George Poole," Jophiel said. "More murky secrets from the family archive." Poole nodded curtly. "This is a ring cemetery."
"I know what that means," Harris said to the two of them. "This isn't just some Poole family secret, you know. The biologists and ecologists have studied the phenomenon ever since the days of your Uncle George."
Cinello frowned.
"Studied what? What is this place?"
Harris glared at the pools and turned to Cinello.
"This is a hive, Cinello. A hive of people. Don't let it upset you. This is all quite characteristic, unfortunately. As you said, Michael, this earthwork is a ring cemetery. They just haul out the bodies of the dead and dump them when they get far enough out, more or less equidistantly from the central structures. So you get this ring of corpses around the centre, just as the insects do, the ants and some animals, the mole rats. Evidently the human versions do the same if you give them room."
Cinello stared at him.
"But all those bodies heaped up. How many people can be in there? The pyramid's not that big. I mean, even in 5,000 years.
"There may be more people in there than you think," Harris said gently. "We can't be sure what we'll find in there," Poole muttered. "The account George Poole left of the incident in Rome back in the 21st century, of the very first of these hives, the first to be discovered anyhow, is still the most complete. But that was a very young system. There were a couple of near misses on Mars before the recovery-era colonization waves opened that world up properly.
We don't know how the social structures and the rest will have evolved across 5,000 years, if undisturbed.
Stop! Halt! Stop walking! Go back! Go back!
The cries they heard now were hastily translated by their systems from a language not unlike the villagers. The group halted, bunching up. Jophiel saw that they had nearly come through the barrier of bones and earth, but the way was blocked now by a thin line of maybe 20 individuals. All had shaven scalps, and the sexes were hard to differentiate, though Jophiel had the impression there were more females than males. They were dressed in shapeless, colourless smocks of some vegetable weave. They seemed old to Jophiel, their skin wrinkled and spotted, their postures stooped. But they all held weapons of some sort, spears, clubs, even a few bows and arrows. They could put up a fight if necessary, Jophiel saw. He made out more of these elderly guards coming out to join those at the barrier, rushing as best they could. Chinello's hand went to her blaster. Weena touched her arm.
No, they will not harm us. They only mean to protect the library. See, already our elders go forward to name us, our people, our reason for coming. They expect us, you see. We sent runners from the village while we waited for you to be ready.
Chinello took her hand off her weapon.
They have good discipline, she said. I didn't hear an alarm being raised, yet here they all are, this big number.
Not discipline, Harris said. Not in the manner you mean. They just react and follow each other's lead. They swarm. They are less like a trained military formation than antibodies clustering around a wound.
Regina's three rules, Poole said. Remember, Jophiel? Jophiel nodded reluctantly.
Listen to your sisters. Do that, and you swarm.
I read about this stuff. I never thought we'd get to see it. I think we're being allowed through that. The guards had backed off to form a kind of corridor through which the visiting party would have to walk to reach the pyramid. But the guards kept hold of their weapons and were silently watchful. The group moved forward.
Oh, Chinello whispered. They smell of milk, and they're all so old.
Sacrificing the elderly, Harris murmured. Another trick adapted from the animals and insects. If an attack comes, block it with the bodies of the old, the worn down, the useless.
He shook his head.
Leith, I'm supposed to be a doctor now.
Poole murmured. It's tough for all of us. There's nothing you can do for them. We just have to get through this.
Asher said, certainly we're learning a lot about High Australia, that such places as this exist, and in quantity. We saw many of these ring features from the air, remember?
Chinello stared at them all.
I still don't know what you're talking about. Hives.
All in good time, Jophiel said. I think we all just want to be sure. After perhaps 20 minutes of very slow walking, they approached the central structure.
Jophiel saw that the pyramid wasn't built of anything like concrete or brick, still less the more advanced technologies of Earth before the Chile. It seemed to consist of little but heaped-up stone, big red sandstone boulders that must have been quarried from what passed for bedrock on this cup world. Stone that was smoothed over by what looked like heat-hardened mud, as Mars red as the rest of the landscape. And here and there Jophiel made out the marks of the fingers that must have done the smoothing and maintained it over millennia. Now more people came out to greet them. Mostly female again, Jophiel saw, most dressed in garments that were just as plain as the guards, one-piece tunics tied at the waist, but cleaner and of a better quality. They were all silent, but they all smiled a little nervously, Jophiel thought. And they bunched together like frightened sheep before these strangers, the couchy crew. The first slaver elders advanced with their baskets of food, meat and fruit and roots, and the girls and women took these with nods of gratitude. "So," Poole said, "with these gifts the plainsfolk are paying. But for what?"
"Stories,"
Weena said, when she had puzzled out what seemed to be a clumsy translation of the question.
"Ah, stories. That we'd forget if we didn't tell. Stories of the days gone by and the people who went before. When I die, my children will come here and sing of my life, my loves, the battles I fought. And the library will remember it forever and sing of me to my children's children when they come in their turn."
She grinned.
"Already my aunt, that lady over there, is telling of how I brought down the ghost woman, though I regret that sincerely. Here."
She handed out baskets of fruit, like heavy apples, to Poole, Harris.
"The librarians like fruit."
Asher nodded.
"And in return,
they will let you in."
She pointed at an entrance, dark.
"Through there. You are special visitors, newcomers. The librarians will want to learn of your battles so they may sing them to your children in future. Sometimes people choose to stay. A few boys, mostly girls. Well, there is plenty of food. You see, people stay for the food. Just don't touch anything or anybody. Don't steal anything."
Poole grinned. "Thank you, Weena. Come on, Harris, Jophiel. Asher, you stay outside. And try to figure out if there's anything useful here." He looked at the doorway and tensed.
"Let's get this done."
"Keep turning right," Weena murmured. "That's the way to the birthing pools. Well, that's what my grandmother told me. On the other hand, the last time she went in there, she never came out again."
Chapter 57. The pyramid was a place of narrow shafts, cut low through the stone, wide enough for two or three of them to pass side by side if they ducked beneath the low ceilings. There was light inside. The deeper they went, the dimmer the light, Jophiel soon discovered, but it was there. It came from shafts artfully cut through the walls.
Artfully cut?
Maybe, but Jophiel was prepared to bet that everything he saw was the product of trial and error, repeated over and over across centuries, millennia even, until the best solution was found. That applied to the air ducts he spotted too, he suspected. Shafts in the walls and ceilings, through which, when he passed, he could feel breezes laden with a cloying smell of milk. As an air conditioning system, it was primitive, it was crude, but it worked. And all without any external power source, save the galaxy center heat that poured down on this world through its filter of a sky, and a human body heat and convections. He was reminded of a family monument, Lillian Poole's recovery-era Goon Hilly Mound in southern England, a conscious expansion of the design principles of a termite mound. Anyhow, it had evidently worked for centuries, as was proved by the people that pressed close as soon as they got more than a dozen paces in from the daylight. A crowd, all around them, filling the passageways. Apparently mostly female, short, bald, blank-faced, eyes wide in the perpetual shade. They pushed along the corridors and practically flowed around the strangers. They were always in contact with each other, Jophiel noticed immediately, always rubbing shoulders, holding hands, whispering, even kissing softly. And at first they reacted to the newcomers too with gentle touches, not in a hostile way and still less sexual, just a brush of the arm, a stroke of the back. That all changed when one of them tried to touch Jophiel. He kept silent as his flesh crumpled into a cloud of brilliant pixels. Immediately their behaviour changed. They stopped coming so close, and instead a group of more or less permanent escorts closed up in a tight wall so that no others could bump up against Jophiel. And as they moved on, Jophiel observed how others backed off and squirmed out of the way as they passed.
"Soon they'll know all about us," Cinello said. "Jophiel and his consistency protocols."
"Listen to your sisters," Poole said. "That rule is mostly what governs their behaviour. If one gets alarmed, they all get alarmed. Mostly it works and is very efficient."
"Another right turn. Let's keep following Wiener's advice."
They passed a couple of chambers, big rooms cut into the rock mound, pierced by air and light shafts of their own. Here Jophiel saw huge vats of what looked like some kind of broth, itself glowing pale green. Bioluminescence, perhaps, a useful trait down here. People lined up in their dozens, hundreds, bowls in their hands to scoop up portions of the soup, while others stirred the vats with vast wooden ladles. If this was a cookhouse or a refectory, it was just as crowded as the corridors. The room was filled with a susurrus of soft whispers. The people here spoke constantly, but no words could be made out. Cinello said,
"So many of them. All of them underground, too. You'd never have known they were all here, thousands under this pyramid."
Asher said,
"And all those other pyramids, too, remember. All across the Cup World, thousands and thousands."
"That is the big advantage," Harris said. "For the genes, anyhow, the sheer number. This is a way of living that delivers a lot of people all living comfortably together."
Cinello thought that over.
"Comfortable? Yeah. That's the right word. They all look comfortable. But I wouldn't be comfortable here."
Poole asked, "Why not?"
"Because they're all the same, doing the same thing."
Poole considered. "Good answer." They passed another chamber, another big room, which seemed to be a dormitory. There were no beds, no bunks, not even blankets. Instead, people were just piled up on top of each other, snuggled in, adults, children. A single big heap, a mound of humanity. Like puppies, Jophiel thought. Wordless, they moved on. Then Cinello coughed, seemed to stagger slightly and shook her head.
"I'm fine."
"Oxygen levels are very low in here," Harris said, consulting a soft screen that glowed in the semi-dark. "Low in terms of normal human requirements. Another common characteristic. The inhabitants here will have a tolerance. Maybe they're even able to withstand extended periods such as minutes or hours with no oxygen at all. If there's a cave-in, for example. Like the naked mole rats on Earth." But he fell silent, as they had come to the entrance to another chamber. This was even vaster than the refectory. This time Jophiel had the sense of a large pool, like an indoor swimming pool, but a pool brimming with a pale white liquid that looked and smelled like milk. In the pool, women swam. Some of them were heavily pregnant, their milk-coated bellies shining in the dim light. One or two had infants with them, very young, who shared the pool with the expectant mothers. Babies, swimming as confident as otters, Jophiel thought. And there were others here too, all female, all naked, slipping through the liquid to supervise the infants, or to bring the mothers bits of food or cups of drink. Cinello looked shocked at the sight, as Jophiel might have expected.
"There's so many of them. And they all look alike, like one big family."
"That's exactly it. That's what they are. Almost all sisters," Harris said gently.
"I know it seems strange. This is a hive, Cinello, a hive of humans, like a colony of ants or bees, and it works the same way. At any one time there are only a few mothers giving birth to the rest. If you aren't a mother, you give up your right to have children of your own in order to help your mother produce more babies, more sisters. It seems strange to us, but in nature it's a very common way of living. It's called eusociality, which actually means a perfect society. On Earth it turned up among the insects, the birds, the mammals, like rats and dogs. And humans, Michael Poole said, as my distant ancestor George found in Rome, which was a very old city on Earth, when he went looking for his lost sister. Jophiel grunted. And he figured out how it worked. Regina's three rules. Sisters matter more than daughters. Harris said, This is what you get in situations where there is nowhere to spread out, to get away from your mother. Probably there was something like a spring here, a bit of well-watered ground. Nothing else for kilometres around, nothing between here and the river, say. When you can't get away from home, you have to cooperate with the family. And that becomes more important than thinking for yourself. You just copy your sisters and they copy you, and the hive organises itself out of all of those little interactions. Ignorance is strength, Poole quoted. Listen to your sisters. You just follow what everybody else is doing and it generally works out. Now one of the swimming women came close to a gravid mother-to-be. She leaned over as if meaning to kiss the mother, but she seemed to vomit, and regurgitated food flowed easily into the mother's mouth.
I have to get out, Cinello said suddenly. I feel like I'm choking.
Maybe you are, Harris said sternly. The hive is rejecting you, just as you are rejecting it. Come on, let's get you out of here. He consulted a soft-screen map and led the way out. Cinello followed with Poole. Jophiel brought up the rear, feeling unreasonably glad to be escaping himself. When they got out of the pyramid, Cinello stumbled away into the light and took deep, shuddering breaths. Harris discreetly checked her over. But Cinello looked less scared than angry, Jophiel thought. She said, Why would anyone want to live like this? Nobody would want to, Harris said. The genes want us to, and what the genes want, they generally get. I've always thought it's a kind of trap for humanity, Jophiel said. People survive, lots of them, and the genes win out. But it's the end of history. The people here descended from Gord Krue, remember? They were just like us, but they have no meaningful future. A hive is an end.
I don't think there's anything for us here, Asher called softly. In the library's collection of data, I mean. The attendants out here were prepared to answer questions. Much of it was surprisingly comprehensible for us. Max was right, actually. There is a lot of family history stuff, who married who murdered who, dynastic squabbles. Some useful lore on unusual weather systems, for instance. Records of once-in-a-generation events. Useful for the locals, I mean.
Poole prompted, But for us, nothing.
They've forgotten where they came from, save for a few trace origin legends. They've forgotten they live on a big wheel. I think it's going to be like this all over this cup world, Michael. This is an arid world, and it's going to be studded by coalescences like this. To quote the name George Poole gave to the hives.
This whole cup world is a trap, Poole muttered. Max is right. The people here aren't going anywhere, and if we don't leave now, while we still have the technology to do it, we never will. He glanced around. Everybody agreed? Then let's get out of here.
Chapter 58. Ship elapsed time since launch, 26 years, 95 days. The departure of the couchy crew from High Australia turned out to be a surprisingly moving sundering. After 5 weeks here, as measured by the local time of Deck 2, it took several flights of the couchy's solitary flyer to lift the crew and their material back from the first slaver village and up to the Rim Mountains, and then through the lid to the vacuum of the upper deck itself. As this process neared its end, with Jophiel intently watching from the village as the flyer disappeared into the sky yet again, Susan Chen approached him.
"You are missing all the fun," she said.
He turned. He hadn't heard her approach. He noticed Weena standing behind her a few paces back, looking awkward, avoiding eye contact, yet clearly wanting something.
"Sorry, Susan. I'm kind of distracted today."
"In case something goes wrong, we're short of fallback options. I mean, we only have one functioning flyer. I suppose we could walk out of here if we had to."
He glanced towards the horizon, where mist hid the rim mountains.
"Heck of a climb up into the vacuum. You'd need skin suits in the end." She smiled, her ageless face barely moving.
"I do worry when you pools begin to dream of such stunts. It is as if you might do it just for the fun of it."
He had to grin. "You got that right. But I suppose if we pools hadn't had that restless streak, we wouldn't be out here in the first place. Which is a pretty damning thing to say, given the ruin that has been brought down on the human race."
She shook her head. "You have a sense of perspective your template lacks, I think. But it would be true arrogance if you pools imagined that the whole of human destiny, indeed the whole of galactic history, had been shaped by your own character flaws."
"Hasn't it?"
She shrugged. "If you hadn't built your wormholes in the 37th century, isn't it possible one of your competitors might have done the same thing in the 38th?
He rubbed his nose ruefully. "There would have been a different statue at the galaxy center, though. To Bill Zeke, maybe."
"Quite. And simply because you strive for some goal, it may not be true that any alternative is failure so much as, well, as a choice of a different path. Suppose your flyer did fail, suppose we did find ourselves stranded here on High Australia. Would that really be so bad? As you know, there have been some who have taken that very option."
He nodded. Somewhat to his surprise, a half dozen of the couchy complement had chosen to stay here with Weena's people. Four were older veterans of cold earth who had had enough displacement in their lives, and Jophiel, in retrospect, supposed they would likely have jumped ship at the first reasonably acceptable port of call. Another was Ben Goober, who had fallen in love, it seemed, with a boy from the village. Given the varying relativistic time shifts to be endured as humans crawled over this tremendous artifact, Jophiel could think of no way in which Ben and the other stay-behinds, once sundered from the crew, could be kept in touch. And yet Ben, like the others, was determined.
"How does Michael feel?"
Jophiel shrugged. "Conflicted, I guess. Well, there's no change there. I do share some of it. I am him. I think he can see why people aren't following. He understands the logic. But he's clinging to a kind of inner core. People have died to get us this far. I have to finish it."
"Is that healthy?"
"I have literally no idea." "He goes on anyhow." Susan said now,
"And we do, in fact, have one volunteer coming the other way."
"Volunteer?" Slowly, understanding ground through his mind.
"Ah.
And that's why you wanted to see me." He looked again at Weena. He saw that she carried her hunting pack with its bows and arrows, as well as another bag filled with what looked like clothes, mementos such as a chicken doll made of wood and feathers, other junk. Weena seemed intensely nervous, but intensely determined.
"It is true. I, Weena, wish to travel with you from the Couchy."
He studied her, trying to think this through, trying to work out what was best for her. "You're the only one of the village who's asked to travel on with us."
"Our people were once like you.
We travelled before we were brought to this place by the first slavers. Now I would travel on in my turn.
He looked around at the village of wood and leather on this rusty plain, the girl before him in skins with a bow and arrow in her pack. Do you understand what it means to travel with us? She shrugged.
I know now that this world is a bowl set in a great table. We will climb out of this bowl and travel to other bowls.
Yes. But the relativistic time displacements. There would be no way back. That's the important thing. You will be as if dead to your family. They will be as if dead to you.
I understand, she said, quietly but firmly. But I have my duty, you see.
Duty?
I might have killed Nicola Emery.
You were only doing what you thought was best.
She shook her head. It was bad judgment. You had weapons that could have destroyed us all in a heartbeat. We were lucky that you were merciful. I should have been more patient, watchful, spared Nicola. Or when I did strike without fail, murdered you in your sleep, for instance.
Jophiel nodded, suppressing a grin. Fair point.
In the event I wounded Nicola unnecessarily, our code is that in that circumstance I must support the victim for as long as is deemed necessary.
Well, if you're sure.
I have another duty too.
And what's that?
She eyed them frankly. I am told you intend to carry the first slaver with you away from this world.
Jophiel nodded. The ghost, yes. We didn't believe we should leave it here, not when we have the capacity to...
Rescue it?
Susan Chen smiled.
Michael Poole always comes to the rescue. I will guard you,
Weena said,
from the first slaver, just as my elders guarded me from it while I grew up.
He thought it over. Very well. Valid arguments. Welcome aboard.
One other thing.
What's that?
Will you tell my mother for me?
Jophiel himself rode the flyer on its last journey out of the village. In all, they had spent nearly 40 days in High Australia, in the Cup World. They had been so high out of the wheel's relativistic pit that a mere 50 years had elapsed in the external universe, and just 5 minutes on Deck One, where the Chidi lurked. Chapter 59. Like the journey from Deck One to High Australia, the journey of the Couchy convoy to their new destination was simple in principle. Simple if you drew it on a soft-screen sketch diagram. As always, Jophiel reflected, it was the sheer, immense, mind-crushing scale of the great artifact over which they crawled that was the real challenge. Their nominal target now was Earth 3, the second Earth-like cup world they had spotted in the hasty survey carried out during the Couchy's first flyby across the wheel up on Deck 3. The seniors all felt nervous, Jophiel thought, about their reliance on this target. After all, they hadn't been able to update their record since the flyby. Once stuck on Deck 1, they had been looking up at the underside of Deck 2, with none of the upper deck surfaces visible. And given they faced a journey of significant fractions of a light year by tracked vehicle, they couldn't afford to make a wrong choice of destination. The best guess was still that Earth 3 was the nearest easily habitable world within their reach. And besides, as Michael Poole pointed out, Deck 3 would give them an even greater time dilation advantage over Deck 1 and the Chidi itself, their ultimate target. So that was where they determined to make for. To get there, they would need to climb a strut up to the third deck. And that meant going back the way they had come, to the nearest strut, 90 days at a brisk 6% of light speed, returning via the countercurrent of the Hull Plate River that had carried them to High Australia. 90 more days.
It sounded fine in theory, but now, after the open spaces of High Australia, to be shut up again inside the convoy trucks was frustrating. Harris spoke darkly of mental health issues among the crew. Still, they got through it. Climbing the strut was the next challenge. As before, it took them a day to transfer the trucks cautiously to the strut's vertical face. Then the climb began. The trucks were like a line of ants, Jophiel thought, climbing through the structure of a giant Ferris wheel. For the first hours, Jophiel huddled with Poole, Asher and Nicola in the lead truck's cabin, watching the deck two surface slowly recede behind them, now looking like an apparently vertical wall. The greatest uncertainty this time was how long it would take to traverse the strut from deck two up to deck three. Poole set out the numbers. "We know we took 10 days, in the hull plate stream, to climb the strut from deck one to two, which was only about an eighth of an astronomical unit, just a third of the distance of Mercury from the sun, say. The climb to deck three is 10,000 times further, more like a jaunt to the Oort cloud." They laid bets on the journey time. Michael Poole aggressively predicted a mere 10 days, a super-fast transition. Jophiel thought it would take a lot longer, 1,000 days perhaps, still by far exceeding the speeds of the first leg of the climb. Nicola frowned as they discussed this, her flawless, silver face reproducing the expression with precision, Jophiel thought. But she had a habit now of rubbing her chest, where Weena's arrow had penetrated her ghost-hide flesh. "Look, we're crossing an interplanetary distance here. One Apool gutship could once have covered in 100 days, burning at one gravity. Not so slow it takes forever, not so fast it's risky. I figure the Chile will make sure the same kind of calculation. I say 100 days, give or take." In the event, it took 103 days before they reached the undersurface of Deck 3. Jophiel avoided a gloating Nicola for hours. Then it was a day of transfer to Deck 3, and to find the river of hull plate that would sweep them to their next destination. Earth 3 was estimated as 241 more days away. Again the crew settled down, more or less reluctantly, to their truck-bound regime for another 8 months. On the 80th day, one third of the way there, Asher called a meeting. The seniors gathered in the lead truck. Jophiel turned up with a sense of inchoate dread. He thought they all seemed restless, nervous, afflicted by cabin fever. What now? The fun part, relatively, turned out to be a review of Asher's team's latest observations of the wheel and its cup worlds. "We've refined our observations of the worlds we spotted before, on the flyby before we came down to deck one, and we spotted plenty more on deck two as we rose up along the spoke and had a chance to take a look back. Even on this deck we've managed to spy out new worlds using high-flying remote probes. Glimpses, anyhow. You do realize we have no sensible estimate of how many cup worlds this structure might support. The cup worlds are pretty sparsely set out, and we don't have a good model for their spacing, let alone their distribution." Poole waved a hand. "Show us some pretty pictures." Images lit up on soft screens spread over the walls of this small cabin, dimples in the hull plate. Most cup worlds seemed never to have been occupied at all. They stood empty, like healed scars. Of the rest, only a few were remotely Earth-like. Asher commented as the images flickered by, "You'll understand we're selecting for suitability here. We left out the Venus-like ovens, the gas giant cloud worlds." She showed them quick highlights. Images of increasingly exotic worlds, worlds so cold that rivers of liquid helium flowed up mountains of water ice that was harder than basalt, worlds hotter than Mercury with surfaces of molten rock and rivers of iron, Asher said.
airless, moon-like worlds, on some of which, Asher said, traces of ghost technologies may have been detected. Ambiguous evidence. But no ghost activity had been spotted on this.